Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Access Closed. My guest today is Steve Greenfield, and the topic of our conversation will be, does your congressperson represent you or the big lobbyist in D.C.? Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm pretty happy today. I just got a negative coronavirus test, so that was great news.
Thank you. That's great. So how are you dealing with the heat?
Mostly by staying indoors with the air conditioning on, quite frankly. It's up in the 90s. My dog doesn't even want to go out for walks at the moment, so
wow.
I can't use that as an excuse. Yeah, hopefully it should be better by tomorrow.
So you're representing, challenging for the 19th seat in New York State Congress. So tell us a little bit about Delgado that a lot of people might not know.
Okay. Well, you know, the main thing to know about him is that he came to this district from Montclair, New Jersey, actually, where he was living while working at a major international Manhattan corporate law firm called Akin Gump, really one of the world's largest firms and a major part of their business operations that they're also one of the world's largest lobbies on any topic, you know, on any field that they represent for their clients, you know, in terms of like getting regulatory relief, getting licensing things eased, all the things that giant corporations need in order to establish multinational operations and save money. Their big operations, including anti-union organizing, you know, anything that's on the straight corporate agenda for what they need. And that's an interesting thing, you know, something we never think about, you know, about that nexus, that area of intersection between corporate law and corporate lobbying, because obviously those two go hand in hand. When someone like you or I hire a lawyer, we're hiring that lawyer kind of in the short run to handle some problem we have, right? We need to buy a house, so I need a real estate lawyer to, you know, to do the paperwork, and then my relationship with that lawyer is over as soon as I buy my house. If I got arrested, I need a criminal defense lawyer. As soon as I get found not guilty, my relationship with that lawyer is over, right? We hire lawyers, ordinary people. We engage with lawyers to handle, you know, ordinary problems that come up in life, you know, or administrative things we need done that involve legal requirements that only someone who's licensed, just like a licensed electrician, right, or something like that. When the job is done, the relationship is over. Your giant corporations, they don't have that kind of relationship. You know, they have ongoing needs, and so they have these giant law firms on permanent retainer. You know, they do pay them for additional specific work when that comes up, but they just generally have, some gigantic corporate law firm, and that law firm justifies its $1,000 an hour billing by the fact that, unlike ordinary lawyers, they have relationships, right? There are six members of Congress, former members of Congress, working as lobbyists at Akin Gump right now, you know, and up until a year and a half ago, Antonio Delgado was working on, I should say 2 years ago, because he did take a leave of absence for the campaign, you know, and would have gone back if he didn't win, that he was working on the legal end, on corporate criminal defense, white-collar crime, regulatory violations. You know, his specialty was actually defending corporations and boards of directors from charges that might have come their way by violating regulatory laws and corporate law. So there's that's the special relationship that people with a lot of money, high net worth individuals, otherwise extremely rich individuals, and a company like Akin Gump and these other giant law firms, you know, Paul Rifkin, Weiss, these giant Wall Street firms, is that they're multinational. They know the laws in every country. They can, and so that's their lobbying is involved in coordinating between governments across the globe and getting things that are needed in a day-to-day way. So, in fact, there's no real distinction between their lobbying work and their legal work on behalf of a specific client, because their lobbying work is how they make themselves attractive to clients in the first place, right? We're always on the game here. You know, we work both sides of the law. We work when you need us to handle laws that already exist, and we also work to get laws made that help you, or have laws that exist that you don't like removed, right? Because and this is a fascinating thing. This is why it turns out that our government, as has been demonstrated by many, you know, college studies, academic studies, is not a democracy. We are a plutocracy, right? A government that is by and large working for the rich and working for the people that can afford the most expensive lawyers and the most expensive lobbyists. Numerous studies have shown that legislation that's adopted in this country tends to be the legislation that was favored by the extremely wealthy and by our large corporations, and not reflect what surveys showed people want legislated. And that's something like 90%, 95%, it's a ridiculous percentage that of the legislation we passed reflects the position on that legislation very extremely rich people and giant corporations. And so something that struck me this week, which is what made me want to talk about this topic this week, is that my incumbent, the Democratic Party opponent that I'm facing in this race, is a recent recipient of a new award. This is the first year that the award's being given. It's called the Jefferson Hamilton Award for Bipartisanship. And I'm going to say something right here, because I'm a big fan of the musical Hamilton that's been on Broadway for several years, and it's about to be shown on streaming on July 3rd. And you know, anybody who has that, I'm not going to support a streaming service, but if anybody has the streaming service, you can Google which one it is. I actually do recommend you see it, because it's a phenomenal work of art. But throughout the whole second act is about this rivalry between Jefferson and Hamilton, with Jefferson as an anti-federalist and Hamilton as the leader of the Federalists, about what would be the proper role of the federal government versus the power of the states. That's the entire second act, basically, is this rivalry between the two of them and this song, where they achieve a compromise on a very, very critical matter at the starting of the country about the role of the Treasury Department. Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury. And so suddenly many, many people, because of the cultural phenomenon of this musical, many, many people are suddenly aware of, the Compromise of 1790, which was not taught in our public school. None of us know what the Compromise of 1790 is. If I call it the Compromise of 1790, you don't know what it is. You know, I never knew what it was. And, you know, it was some deal between Hamilton and Jefferson to expand the ability of the federal government to take on credit for the various states and relieve their debt in exchange for the Washington, D.C. being put in the South instead of keeping it in New York City or Philadelphia, right? Very arcane piece of history, but suddenly everyone knows about it because it's at the very heart of this, you know, award-winning and enormously popular Broadway show. So the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which happens to be the biggest and most powerful corporate lobby in the country, and has its headquarters like a block away from the White House. You can literally walk from their headquarters to the White House through an underground tunnel, which they have like for security reasons, has given Antonio Delgado its inaugural award for bipartisanship. And they're basically giving this award, as they say, that it's for members of Congress who in their actions have demonstrated a willingness to work across the aisle in support of common objectives. And so they've given this award to 20 members of the House and 10 senators. And one of them is Antonio Delgado, whom they rank. And the way that they give the award is very simple. It's not a complicated algorithm to figure out who's going to get this award. It's basically awarded to people who have co-sponsored the most legislation that was submitted by the other party. Not just voted for it, but actually put their name on it as a co-sponsor. And so what you've got here is an award from America's largest and most powerful corporate lobby. And they're giving their award, obviously, to people that they feel have worked together in a bipartisan way to provide the most legislation that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce deems important to their interests and the interests of their corporate clients. That is what this Aiken-Gump lawyer, whose job was to do this in the private sector at the highest national and international levels, is truly one of the giant firms. And I told people about this 2 years ago, that this man is being sent here. You know, he was carpetbagging. He never lived a day of his life in this district. He wasn't born or raised here. He didn't go to college here, and his entire career as a lawyer was outside the district. As I said, he was working in Manhattan and living in Montclair, New Jersey, a commuter suburb, outside the city. And he bought a $600,000 house here and entered the Democratic primary, like the next day, and got two seats, one for himself and one for his wife, on the Dutchess County Democratic Committee and the town of Rhinebeck Democratic Committee. And I told people from the beginning, what are you doing? Why are you even giving this person a decent look? You've got seven candidates in the primary. Why are you giving a hard look? Why are you giving your votes and your support to someone who is clearly here by design? He came here with the most money already in his campaign chest, and all that money comes from Aiken Gump. It comes from this multinational law firm, and their clients. And so here we are. He's been legislating for, 17 months now, and he's already the recipient of the inaugural award that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is giving out to the specific members of Congress who have worked together across the aisle to legislate in the manner most conducive to the interests of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It only took him, 17 months to become one of the 535 members of Congress and Senate. And in 17 months, he's already made himself. I think they ranked him as fifth out of 535 in working together with Republicans to serve corporate interests. And there's no surprise there, right? There's no surprise. He was sent here with a giant campaign chest to try to achieve that. And he's done so. There it is. He's finally been put on the record. That's what he's been doing. Our biggest corporate lobby is now certifying him as tops in the nation of working with Republicans to serve corporate interests. And now, of course, he puts out a press release about this, and it was covered very widely in the press and covered completely uncritically. Like, it was just covered sort of in an encapsulated brief way. Antonio Delgado wins this major award. He's won a major award given out by a major institution. His press release, of course, on it, as press releases tend to do, you gather a bunch of quotes from people who say nice things about you, and you incorporate that into your press release. So, I'll read for you who the people speaking with these wonderful supportive quotes. We applaud and congratulate Congressman Delgado on receiving this recognition for a bipartisan approach, said Jeff Friedman, Greene County Chamber of Commerce. That's one of the counties in our district. The next quote is from Ray Pucci, the president of the Delaware County Chamber of Commerce. The next quote is from Barbara Ann Hegan, president and CEO of the Otsego County Chamber of Commerce. Ward Todd, the president of the Ulster County Chamber of Commerce. And Kate Manley, the president of the Rensselaer County Chamber of Commerce. So basically, our regional satellite offices of this massive national corporate lobby are all complimenting. And so that means that they're providing the support that makes this announcement travel, right? That makes it newsworthy, that gets it into the news. And so everybody's just seeing like, oh, he's kind of a breaking gridlock kind of guy, right? It almost sounds good, right? It's, hey, he breaks up gridlock. He gets things done. Except, you know, when somebody's getting something done, you're supposed to ask, what is it they got done? and who's happy that they did it, right? Like, for example, Hillary Clinton has a tremendous amount of experience. And so, yeah, she has a tremendous amount of experience starting invasions of, you know, non-defensive wars, killing a million innocent people in wars that are still going on after 18 years and have never stopped. So, like, yes, she has experience. But is it good experience? Is it experience? Is it, you, do you want to give, does that experience indicate that you want to give her even more power to continue doing those things, right? The critical thinking part, the like saying, okay, well, what's the award for? Nobody ever does that. This war, this award is not pretending to be anything other than what it is, right? It's the award for people who set aside public interests, okay? When we use the word partisan interest, most of what drives that is the difference in belief systems of what constitutes the public interest, right? At least the leadership, and that's how the two parties present themselves, right? One party wants a higher minimum wage, and the other party doesn't because they think it'll be a burden on business. One party wants to have equal pay for women, and the other one thinks the free market should be setting wages and not federal legislation. One party thinks that gay people should have the right to work and not be kicked out of their housing, and the other party thinks that religious freedom the freedom of personal belief should allow people to do whatever they want, even if it's discriminatory, right? So in some regards, the platforms and the difference and why people are partisan in the first place has a lot to do with how different groups of people view the public interest and how the United States should be run, what should be our organizing principles, and how do we legislate around making sure that those organizing principles become operational and become the actual performing character of the United States. And so when you see people talking about, you know, tearing down partisanship, they're talking about basically setting aside their central belief systems about organizing principles and the character of the nation. And in some instances, there is a lot of good to be found in certain things. If there's a problem that needs to be solved, the problem we're having right now, right? Everybody's unemployed. We tend to like it if the government is doing something to solve that. And you may find some Republicans who will ease up on their opposition to public hiring because people are starving and there's some critical emergency, right? And of course, we're not even seeing that in Washington right now, but there could be some times where that's good. Most of the time, unfortunately, when you look at these kinds of things, it means that they're joining together in naming a post office somewhere, you know, something that doesn't really matter. In this instance, they're citing something that both of our previous Republican congressmen were doing, both Fazio and Chris Gibson, before him, which was co-sponsoring legislation on researching Lyme disease, how to treat Lyme disease. And on the surface, that sounds great, right? It almost sounds like who could argue with funding research into how to cure Lyme disease. This is obviously in the 19th district here. Lyme disease is a pretty big deal, and so that sounds great, you know. But the other thing that the two sides of the aisle are agreeing on in funding this research is that they're agreeing not to let people have sufficient health insurance to pay for the cure if they figure out how to cure it. You know, so what they're really doing when they're financing this, and here's something, you know, most people don't know. When the United States government funds medical research, if that medical research succeeds in creating a treatment for something, surgical, pharmacological, whatever it is, the patent for the medication is given to private pharmaceutical companies. We, the people, even though we put up all the investment money. Now, this is pretty weird because in an ordinary situation, if I invest in a pharmaceutical company that's researching something and that research pays off, they find the cure and or at least a treatment, and that treatment is going to now go into use in the medical profession, I'm going to make a lot of money. That turns out to be a smart investment. That's why there's so much insider trading in medical business, medical equipment and pharmaceuticals, because people in the company tip off their friends when they know something is about to be patented. So I made a smart investment. It paid off, and now I'm rich, right? Most of our diseases are researched with federal funding, with universities and private labs that are owned by pharmaceutical companies. And then when something is discovered, the private companies get the patent. So we put up billions of dollars out of our tax money, and we don't even get a piece of the action like a regular investor would if that turns out. All the money goes to the businesses and the doctors and everybody that's involved, and then providing the treatment once it's been approved by the FDA. And so this is what's happening with the Lyme disease situation, right? They are being awarded for bipartisanship in funding research, because if this research pays off, the pharmaceutical companies and the doctors and the medical equipment companies and everybody involved in whatever treatment is eventually discovered is going to get very, very rich. They're going to keep all the billing money without having had to put up any of the research money. And we, the taxpayers, are going to be completely ripped off because we put up all the research money without even being treated like investors that are going to start getting our investment back once the treatment goes into use. And also, they're not going to be altering the payment system. They're not going to be challenging the control of Aetna and Blue Cross and United Healthcare over the insurance industry and the profits on that. And so this is, of course, the perfect form of bipartisanship for a lobby like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They're providing a revenue stream to the private sector to do the research, so that's keeping them employed, and they're doing the research at a profit. They're billing the federal government a nice profit to do this contracted out research, and so that's costing them nothing, and it's a steady revenue stream that includes a margin of profit. And then if it works out, if a cure is discovered, then they make billions come flooding in, forever. Including to the insurance market, right? And so this is actually bad, right? It would be good to fund research if we legislated that research in such a manner that made the FDA and the National Institutes of Health and the agencies that are actually putting up the money for the research, if the legislation included making us shareholders along with the contracted companies in the returns on this investment, if it ever pays off, right? It would be great if we had a cure for a chronic disease, if people could actually afford to go to the doctor and pay for the treatment. I mentioned that I just got a coronavirus test back negative this morning, and I'm thrilled about that. I'm not thrilled that I'm not sure that my insurance company is going to pay for that test. And the reason for that is that the terms of most private insurance is that they only pay for what they call medically necessary tests, right? They're not just going to go screen me for cancer. I have to have a lump. I have to, whatever, something, a blood test that shows, so they don't, they don't want to just pay for testing for like fishing expeditions, right? There has to be some medical necessity to the testing. And since I didn't have any coronavirus symptoms, and since I don't have a referral from my doctor saying, he's got a fever and a runny nose and a cough, and so I'm doing this testing. I basically got screened. I was concerned I might have been in contact with somebody. And I didn't even know that for sure because the person I came in contact with did not have a test. And so I basically was getting myself screened. And so I'm not certain right now that that's not coming out of my pocket. And the reason that that's significant is because most people in this country that have private insurance have very high out-of-pocket deductibles for routine care, doctor visits, testing, and their coverage is really only for if they get diagnosed for something catastrophic that's going to be expensive, right? And that's because they can't afford, you know, platinum plans that actually cover your annual physical and testing without referral and stuff like that. And so this is essentially the very core of the problem. And so we wanted to talk about how do you know if your member of Congress is working for you or if he or she is working, you know, for corporate America and the extremely wealthy people. And there's a simple way to know that. And I'll tell you what it is right now. Every member of Congress has a website. You know, not just their campaign website. They all have one, a government website. It'll be their last name with a dot and then the word house and then another dot and then the word gov, G-O-V. So, you know, Delgado's is delgado.house.gov. And that'll take you to their website. And every one of these websites is set up essentially the same. They have some banners on the top that say about, contact, media, services and events. Services are like, you know, if you want to reserve a ticket to tour the White House, right? Or if something, you know, you need to, that's services. Media is the one that you want to focus in. That's where they put out their daily press releases, you know, what they want the press to write about them. So you go on the media banner and look at all the press releases and then, you know, read who are the people. Every press release tries to have, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 quotes from people to say what a wonderful person and what a tremendous accomplishment or whatever is the topic of the press release that's out. So all you need to do is go look at those press releases and see who's saying the confirming quotes that are included in the press release. And you'll see that almost all the time, and this is just because of, you know, the response of the media that they're seeking. They're trying to get, quote unquote, important people. You know, names that the press will recognize. And who are the names that the press recognizes? It's the people who have their own permanent media outreach divisions, right? The Chamber of Commerce in every county, they always put out press releases. Labor unions, anybody, you know, significant institutions that are trying to garner public support. And so, you know, if you form an anti-war demonstration this week, you're probably not going to get a lot of press coverage because you don't have an ongoing relationship with the press, whereas the Chamber of Commerce not only has an ongoing relationship with the press is a member of the Chamber of Commerce. They're a corporate, they're a corporation, and they're joined in this operation. So you're going to get coverage. And so that's what people need to do. Go onto your own senator or congress member's website, open up the page that says media, and read through these sites, and it will jump out at you. Just read 5 or 6 of them, and it will jump out at you when you see the names, and of course the names are attached to whatever institution they're speaking for. You will see that we are not represented, period. There's never a congressional press release that just says, you know, Cynthia Pooler of Albany, New York, thinks this is great. You know, it's always so-and-so, the president of the Albany Chamber of Commerce, whatever is the thing, the institution, the thing. That's how the game works. And when you do that, you're getting, as a member of Congress, you're getting the names of the leaders of these institutions into the press. And in exchange for that and for representing their interests, they're using their reach into the media to support your reelection. And to say that they're happy about what you did and you're a great member of Congress and, boy, the district really needs people like you. And so the two hands are washing each other on and on and on and on every single day of every session, everything they do. None of it's about us. Literally none of it. None of it is about us.
On that note, Steve, we've got to give yourself a little plug. Tell us what you're running for. And I welcome Antonio Delgado. Come on this show to talk about what his opponent, Steve Greenfield, has. So give yourself a little plug.
Okay, Green Party candidate for Congress, 19th District. Come to my website, stevegreenfieldforcongress.com. See what the difference is between a corporate platform and a people-oriented platform. And you can send me email at greenfieldforcongress@gmail.com because I answer all inquiries personally and not through a media campaign staff member. And I actually would like to challenge Antonio Delgado to a debate specifically on Lyme disease. I don't even want to have a generalized. I would love to have a conversation about what he's doing about Lyme disease and what's wrong with that instead of all the popular press about what's right with it. So, you know, let's do this, Antonio. Let's have this out in front of the people if you're not afraid to have that conversation.
Okay, Steve, thanks, and I will call Delgado's office. Thanks for being on All Edge Closed, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a wonderful day.